Hello, I'm Richard Feidler. Thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are plenty more conversations about things you're interested in and things you don't know you're interested in yet. Not until you try them anyway. Go to abc.net.au/conversations or to iTunes, where you can get lots more for free.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, welcome to Conversations. Every day, people like you and me, we travel in cars and planes, we use the phone, we use the telly, we use the internet. And the act alone of listening to this right now on your radio or on your iPod, that kind of makes you a modern person. But you're a modern person with a caveman body, more or less. So even though you live in easy reach of delicious fatty or sugary food, your caveman body is sending you urgent signals telling you that such foods are rare and precious and essential to your survival if you are to store up fat for lean times. So if I was to ask you why most people are overweight, you'd most likely say too much fat and too little exercise. But David Gillespie says that's not right at all. David argues that the real villain here is sugar, or more specifically, the sugar called fructose. And fructose, it turns out, is everywhere in your supermarket foods. In breakfast cereals, fruit juices, muesli bars, and a whole lot of other things, even tinned tomatoes. Now, I should hasten to add at this point that David Gillespie, he's not a nutritionist or a scientist or a doctor. He was a somewhat overweight lawyer. And after doing some reading, he decided to cut fructose from his diet. He started to lose weight and it stayed off. Well, what he's found out about sugar, though, and how much we consume of it is startling. In some ways, David Gillespie is telling us that everything we think we know about the obesity epidemic is wrong, or kind of backwards. He says that when you add up how much money you spend on diet foods or going to the gym or hiring a personal trainer, you'd be better off putting all that cash on your mortgage if you go back to consuming fructose. And that fructose, he says, is making us overweight and unwell. David Gillespie wrote his first book called Sweet Poison 2 years ago. He's now followed that up with The Sweet Poison Quit Plan. David Gillespie, welcome to Conversations.
Good to be here.
You are the anti-Willy Wonka.
That's right.
You are the anti-Easter Bunny, aren't you? That's you, isn't it?
Well, anti-Easter Bunny, anti-Easter Egg. The bunny can still come.
I think we know, like, I keep my kids and don't really give them much sugar at all in their diets. And so when someone comes around, a well-meaning friend of the family or relative, and gives them a sugar, they bang around like a ball bearing in a milk bottle for a while. It tends to have that effect on kids.
It does. And not just kids. It has that effect on lots of people. It's an energizing thing. Sugar is often marketed as pure energy.
When we're talking about sugar, let's break it down here. Sugar's broken down, to use a bit of a pun there. There are only three real sugars, ultimately, aren't there?
Well, there's lots of sugars, but there are three that we're likely to encounter on a daily basis. Three primary sugars, and that is glucose, which is the most important one from our perspective. Now, glucose is our fuel. Everything we eat in terms of carbohydrates is broken down to glucose and used by our bodies for energy. It's dominant in the environment. There's another less common sugar called fructose, which we're going to talk a lot more about, which in its natural state really only occurs as part of ripe fruit. So that's hence the name. It sounds a little bit like fruit. And then the other only really important one that we'll encounter on a daily basis is galactose, which is one half of lactose and is the sugar found in milk.
So table sugar, that's sucrose, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, sugar is a combination of two of those simple sugars. So that's the glucose and the fructose. So you take glucose, fructose, join them together, and you've got something called sucrose, which is table sugar.
And lactose, you said that's a combination of galactose and...
glucose.
And glucose.
Yes.
So every sugar we encounter then is a combination of two or three...
Well, it's a little more complex than that, but for most of the things that we encounter, yes. They're either just those sugars on their own or they're combinations of them.
So most... what sugar then is added to processed food that we get, most commonly added to processed food?
Most common is sucrose, table sugar. So ordinary everyday sucrose is added to most foods, and it will appear on the label of most foods in the ingredient list as sugar.
So that sucrose, though, is
That sucrose is half fructose. That's right.
It's half fructose.
Yes.
Is there a taste difference between these sugars, between glucose, galactose and fructose?
Not in terms of flavour, but in terms of sweetness, yes. Now, of those, glucose and galactose are barely sweet at all. I mean, they're slightly sweet, but if you tasted them, you'd say, not terribly sweet. Fructose is intensely sweet. It's very, very sweet. And sucrose is close to fructose, but not quite. So sugar, the sweetness of sugar is right up at that end of the spectrum, the sweetness end.
So when we're getting that flavour, that sugar flavour hits, that's mostly fructose.
That's
then.
Mostly the fructose.
Mostly
yes.
The fructose.
Yeah.
What is different now between the amount of fructose that we consume compared to, say, 150, 200 years ago?
Okay, so we've only really in the last 150 years or so learnt how to create commercial quantities of what we call table sugar. Before that, it really was an intensely manual process. Sugar was quite expensive and really was beyond the reach of the everyday man. You really had to be royalty to afford it. But we commercialised and were able to produce serious quantities of it in the early 1800s. Since that time, the average consumption of sucrose has gone through the roof. So prior to then, early 1800s, we were all eating about a kilogram a year of fructose.
A kilogram a year?
A kilogram a year.
So it was like
a
rare delicacy, in other words.
Very rare.
The common...
Well, and the reason was it wasn't in much. We weren't eating that much fruit. We only ate it when it was ripe and when it was in season. No one was flying in bananas from Brazil for us. So we just weren't eating that much. So it came from the fruit, and it also came from the occasional when we had a bit of honey. But to get honey, we had to have a discussion with the bees about it. So that was a bit unusual as well. Yeah. So a kilogram a year amounts to 2 kilograms a year of table sugar, effectively. So a kilogram a year of fructose. Bring that forward to today, and what the average Australian is consuming now is about 30 to 33 kilograms a year of fructose.
So you're saying it's anything but like a 15 to 30-fold increase?
Absolutely. In the space of 150, 170 years.
15 to 30-fold increase in our intake of this sugar over that time. Hmm. You say in your book it was probably things like coffee and cocoa that gave people the taste. For sucrose, where they didn't have it before.
That's right, because coffee and cocoa, when they first came into our diet, were bitter things to be added to food. So they were spices. And then someone had the brilliant idea of combining the cocoa with sugar to produce chocolate. And suddenly, cocoa is not a bitter spice to be added in tiny little amounts. It's suddenly something you can eat in very large quantities. But that really didn't happen until Cadbury came out with the first dairy milk chocolate in about 1905.
Out of the three basic sugars you're talking about here, glucose, fructose, and galactose, why single out fructose? What is the issue for fructose and us? What does it do to us?
Well, now the understanding on what fructose does to us is very, very recent indeed. So in terms of molecular biochemistry, only in the last 10 years or so have we really begun to have a complete understanding of what fructose does. Prior to that, it was really observational guesswork. There have been papers written since the 60s where people have said, you know what, when I feed these rats sugar, horrible things happen to them. They get fat, their livers expand, their hearts expand, all sorts of nasty things happen. But in terms of explaining that, the research was very thin on the ground because in order to explain it, you had to get down and understand exactly how our hormones work. And that really has only happened in the last 10 years when 3 of the 4 major appetite hormones have been discovered. But I'll give you a potted summary.
You can, that'd be good. So this is essentially what you're about to tell me now is why fructose makes people fat.
Not just makes them fat, but also makes them quite sick.
Unwell.
Yeah. So the first thing about fructose to know is that it is metabolized by our bodies immediately to fat. By the time you finish that glass of apple juice, the first mouthful is already circulating in your blood as fat. It is a blindingly efficient process. Fructose pushes aside everything else in the metabolism pathways in our liver and gets first cab off the rank, goes straight through, straight to fat. Very, very efficient. Now, that's a bad thing because immediate creation of fat obviously will make you fat. But that's by far nowhere near the worst of it. All that extra circulating fat has a number of other flow-on effects. The first is that we become resistant to two of our major appetite control hormones, insulin, which is the immediate response to food, and leptin, which is a sort of a longer-term hormone produced by our fat cells. Both of these hormones are designed to ensure that we stop eating. It might sound an odd sort of a thing, but we have these hormones that will say, okay, you've had enough, stop now. You've got enough energy, you're right to go. So the short-term one is in response to what you're eating right now, and the longer-term one is in response to the between meals. So, all right, we've got plenty of fat, we can keep going. If you become resistant to those two hormones, then your switch is sort of stuck at half on in terms of appetite control. You don't get a signal that says, stop eating. You have a clouded message which says, well, you know what, I could have dessert. So you can keep on eating. So it messes with the appetite control in that way. So not only does the food itself make you fat, the fructose, it also gives your body permission to eat more of everything, which in turn allows you to get fatter still.
And you're saying this is the what you're telling me now is the product of quite recent research.
Yes, that's right. So over the last 10, when I say recent, I mean over the last 10 years.
That's recent, yeah.
Yes.
When you go down the supermarket aisle then, what kind of products are rich in fructose, this thing that's turns into fat quite quickly and suppresses our appetite suppressors?
Well, the obvious things, obviously. You know, no one would have any trouble identifying the things in the confectionery aisle or the things in the soft drink aisle that are full of sugar. It's when it gets a bit tricky is in some of the other aisles. So, for example, one of the biggest areas of sugar consumption for the average Australian is in breakfast cereal.
Breakfast cereal.
Very few breakfast cereals contain reasonable amounts of sugar. In fact, most contain between 20 and 30% sugar. Now, that is an extraordinary thing for something that everybody eats every day.
20 to 30% sugar. So if I've got a big bowl of cereal, nearly a third of that, or a fifth to a third of that, is sugar.
Yeah, and in fact, some of the ones that are marketed as being healthy, some of the ones where all the advertising is about how healthy they are for you. There's one running right at the moment. I saw it before I came in.
Someone wearing a tank top sitting in an open balcony with a fruit bowl.
Exactly.
Who's just been jogging.
You've seen the
They're eating a giant plate of sugar with a bit of fibre with that as well.
That particular one is about 32% sugar. So and it's not unusual. I've got to stress this. It's not unusual. Most people would have no trouble identifying the obviously sugary breakfast cereals that are marketed at kids.
My producer's getting my ear and wants you to just confirm that doesn't apply to porridge.
Now, porridge is the exception. Anything made with unflavoured rolled oats is fine. Sugar content of unflavoured rolled oats is almost zero.
As opposed to the rolled oats you get in little sachets that have got flavours on them.
Those ones will run you 20 to 30% sugar because the flavouring is another word for sugar. And particularly the ones that say things like honey or similar flavours. Honey is often a pseudonym for extra sugar. So breakfast cereals, as a general rule, there are really only two exceptions with breakfast cereals. That's the rolled oats that we mentioned and unflavoured wheat biscuits. So, you know, the wheat biscuit type ones, if they're not flavoured, they're also extremely low in sugar. But everything else has significant quantities
of sugar. Heaped tablespoons of sugar. So you know, when I was a kid, we used to add sugar. Yeah. And now we say, well, no, we're good because we don't add sugar.
Yes.
And so their cereal isn't too sweet now.
Well, we don't have to add sugar. See, because
it's in the box.
The cereal manufacturers have been busily adding it for us. In
Slipping
fact,
it in.
If you look at the progress of, take a given brand of cereal over time and look at how much sugar was in it in 1970 and how much in 1980 and how much in 1990 and how much now, you'll see a steady upward increase in the amount of sugar.
But I can see a problem straight away with what you're telling me, though, because wheat biscuits in their various brands and porridge, it's kind of inedible unless you add sugar or honey to it.
It is, as long as you are addicted to sugar. And that's an important point, is that besides making you fat, it also happens to be highly addictive. Now,
you're saying sugar...
Sugar is addictive.
Is addictive.
That's right. And
it's an opiate of a kind.
Well, it isn't, but it appears to create an opiate. And this is an interesting point. Sugar itself is not an opiate. And on its own, would not be addictive. But in humans, it turns out it produces an addictive effect. Because one of the other things that sugar does when we eat it is increase our levels of cortisol, which is a homemade opiate. It's our own opiate, and it's a very useful one for us because when we're confronted by an angry bear, we need all certain systems turned on, the ones involved with running away, and we need certain systems turned off. We don't need to worry too much about our immune system. The bear's going to kill us before bacteria will, and we don't need to worry too much about our appetite or any of those sorts of peripheral systems. So cortisol's a very useful hormone to us, but it's an opiate. And it's one that we really enjoy.
And you're saying the production of cortisol is stimulated then by sugar.
So instead of the occasional bear attack stimulating vast amounts of cortisol, we're stimulating it every time we have sugar. So not just the sugar we add to our tea and coffee, the sugar that's in our breakfast cereal, the sugar that's in our yogurt, the sugar that's in our bread, all of those things are stimulating the production of a homegrown opiate. So it's addictive.
Anti-fructose warrior David Gillespie is my guest. His books are called Sweet Poison, published 2 years ago, and Sweet Poison Quit Plan, which has been published this year. So breakfast cereals going down the supermarket aisle, rich in fructose.
Yes, and all to be avoided.
In fact, the whole suite of breakfast foods are rich in the sugar that you say is bad for us. Fruit juices. Let's talk about fruit juices.
Now, fruit juices are an extraordinarily bad example. They've been marketed with a health message. And they've gotten away with it for years. The reality is, though, that your average glass of apple juice contains more sugar than an equivalent glass of soft drink. And that's bad news. There's nothing healthy about juice. Juice is the waste product of fruit, retained and sold, and the good stuff in fruit thrown away. So when you juice a piece of fruit, what you're doing is throwing away the fiber and keeping the sugar. And so there's nothing good about juice. In fact, if you had the average healthy breakfast cereal and a 500ml glass of juice every morning for breakfast, by the end of the week, you'd be at about 440 grams of sugar just from that, before you looked at anything else.
Sugar.
That's right. So you can see that it's very easy to get yourself up towards the 60 kilo a mark a year in terms of sugar consumption, without adding sugar to anything. Even if you didn't eat another piece of sugar all day long, just from that healthy breakfast, cereal and juice, you'd have a significant quantity.
Many juices advertise themselves as having no added sugar.
Why would you add sugar to something that's already got more sugar than a soft drink? You'd be silly.
It's extraordinary. Tell me about the disguised sugars in everyday processed foods, like tins of tomato, for example, a lot of tin foods.
Tin foods. It's interesting because a lot of foods are marketed as the same thing. You'll go to the shelf, you'll see tin food, lots of different brands. Some of them add sugar in and some of them don't. And the difference is that the ones that add sugar in probably sell an awful lot more than the ones that don't. And the easiest way to tell is just look at the label, and they have to list sugar in the ingredient list if it's there. But they rely on the fact that most people go by what's on the front of the label, which says it's tomatoes, not tomatoes and sugar.
I actually get to the point now that I'm in my 40s, I can't read those labels anymore.
They're very small.
Glasses
that's
on.
Right, I agree with you.
So that can be a real problem as well. How about products like yogurts?
Now, yogurt is very tricky because... Let's start from a basic proposition. Yogurt is sour. So any yogurt that you taste that is not sour has had something added to it. And the something is often vast amounts of sugar. And the really interesting thing about yogurt is that they go on this whole health food line, which is they say it's light because yogurt has been the target of the people who say you shouldn't eat too much fat. And so there's all these light yogurts. They often have significantly more sugar in them than their full-fat cousins. So same brand, one's full-fat, one's light. The light one has significantly more sugar in it. Worse than that, they have now taken a few brands to saying no added cane sugar on the labels. And that, to me, would say, oh, well, there mustn't be any sugar in this. And in fact, when I first started out on this, that was something that really fooled me. I was feeding yogurts to my kids thinking, oh, geez, isn't this a great win? I've got something that doesn't taste sweet. The kids love it. Oh, sorry, that does taste sweet. The kids love it. But look, it says it's got no added sugar on it. The reality is that when you get in and look at the really fine print on the label, no, there is no added cane sugar to it. But what appears in the list is concentrated fruit juice, which is another way of saying pure fructose. So it's worse than saying it has no cane sugar in it. At least cane sugar is only half fructose.
Fruit juices, What about, you know, homemade fruit juice, you know, when you actually juice a bit of fruit and, you know, the orange from the orange juicer or something like that with real fruit? And
it doesn't matter whether you juice it or the man in the moon juices it. If the end result is that you're keeping the sugar in the water and throwing everything else away, then you're keeping the worst bits. The only acceptable way of juicing a fruit, from my perspective, is to create a smoothie of it where you throw the entire fruit in. Well, take the peel off a banana first. That might be a bit unpleasant.
Yes. Glad you said that.
That's right. Throw the entire fruit in and eat the entire fruit. Now, if you happen to like your food liquefied, then fair enough. But as long as you're eating the entire fruit, then that's fine.
How do nutritionists react when they hear you say cut out fruit juices? Because there is the argument that fruit juices are a kind of a gateway, if you like, into real fruits. It gives kids a taste for real fruit.
A taste for real fruit. A fruit juice gives kids a taste for sugar. Kids know that, but they're not going to fess up to it because, hey, mum and dad are making me drink this stuff that tastes like soft drink. In fact, a lot of the juice manufacturers are now doing carbonated versions to keep the kids even further onside. There's nothing good about a fruit juice. Now, fruit juice manufacturers might say, oh, you know, but it's got all those vitamins in it. The vitamins in fruit juice are vitamin A and vitamin C, and there are no serious deficiencies of either of them in the Australian population today. In fact, it would take you a couple of months to become vitamin C deficient and take on scurvy. That's if you couldn't get vitamin C from anywhere else. And then the cure would be half a packet of French fries, by the way. It would give you enough vitamin C to keep you going. So the notion that any of us are vitamin C deficient is rubbish.
David Gillespie is here, a former lawyer and a former somewhat overweight lawyer. He's my guest at the moment. When he decided to examine just why he was fat, despite years of dieting, he was somewhat shocked to find out the role that sugar was playing in his diet and his largeness and his health issues as well. His book is called Sweet Poison, Why Sugar Makes Us Fat. Now, poison's a really strong word. Mm. Now, you could make calling a sugar a poison. Have you ever done it there a bit? Because, I mean, anything's a poison if you consume it in large enough quantities, like nutmeg or, you know, alcohol we consume, and that's a poison, I suppose. There are no such thing as poisons, but there are poisonous doses of things, surely.
Well, it's probably more the difference between an acute effect and an accumulative effect. Both are labelled as poison, perfectly validly labelled as poison. You can have a cumulative dose of arsenic. The reason people rail a little bit at calling it a poison is that there's no acute effect from sugar. You don't take a mouthful of sugar and drop down dead there and then. But my argument is it's a cumulative effect. Many of the diseases which flow on, and we've talked a little bit about weight being one of the things, but it's by far and away the least important, strange enough. It certainly was the thing that motivated me, but no one dies from being fat. What people die from are the insidious chronic diseases which flow from exactly the mechanism that I described before.
So how does then fructose specifically act on the body over time?
Okay, so remember before that I said it fills the arteries with circulating fat, and the immediate effect of that is appetite control, where you get permission to eat anything you like and you get fatter. But there's a more insidious effect, which is that constant buildup of insulin resistance, so that insulin resistance over time eventually leads to type 2 diabetes, in that what happens with insulin resistance is your body compensates. If your body is resisting the signals of insulin, your body compensates and creates more insulin and more insulin and more insulin until it can't create enough. And ultimately, the insulin-creating organ, which is our pancreas, fails, and you result in becoming a type 2 diabetic. So that's one chronic disease outcome from exactly that same mechanism. Another one from filling your arteries with fat is obviously heart disease. So you have that over time as too. It's going to take you 40 to 50 years for enough fat to accumulate for that to be a problem, but it will be a problem. Another one that results from that is that at the same time as doing all of these things, it's been shown that fructose also does things like increase nitric oxide depress our nitric oxide production, which can lead to asthma, which is some really interesting research which is going on at the moment. So
it has these long-term effects. Is there any point to cutting fructose, though, if you've been eating it for 20 years or more?
Well, I certainly hope so, because I ate it for 37 years before I cut it out. So, look, the immediate obvious effect is that you start losing weight. The next obvious effect is that your appetite comes back under control. Suddenly you can eat nowhere near as much as you used to be able to, or as you used to be able to eat your entire life. So that's an immediate effect as well. And I'm hoping that there are longer term effects as well.
Are there withdrawal symptoms you get?
There are indeed withdrawal symptoms.
from taking sugar out of your diet.
That's right. Now, that's really interesting. The mere fact that you could say to most people, listen, I want you to give up sugar, and most people would actually hesitate at that, tells you straight away that this may be different to other food.
Well, I'm hesitating too, I must admit. Yeah, sugar. No. Like, I was saying this before, I'm looking at the picture of the donut on the cover of your book, and I'm ready to eat the paper.
Yeah, no, so there is a clearly difference. If I told you to give up broccoli tomorrow,
yeah,
even if broccoli was your favourite food in the whole world,
done.
Do it. You'd do it. No question at all.
Yeah.
Sugar is very different indeed. You tell someone to give up sugar and their reaction is very much more like a smoker when you tell them that they've got to have their last drag.
Defensive, irritable,
that's right.
Weird.
And I could do that anytime, but I'm not going to.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. On ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Former lawyer and anti-fructose campaigner David Gillespie is my guest. His latest book is called The Sweet Poison Quit Plan. His first book was called Sweet Poison, Why Sugar Makes Us Fat. And he says it's predominantly sugar that is leading to rising obesity and the health problems associated with that. Tell me about your own, the food you were brought up on as a kid, because food now isn't the kids get now isn't quite the same as when we were kids, and certainly not when our grandparents were kids.
Well, no, exactly. I was a kid in the 70s, and you know, I probably ate a fairly standard sort of a diet for a kid in the 70s. The only conscious notice I took of sugar was, I guess, we had dessert a fair bit, or pudding, and it would usually be tinned fruit, a bit of ice cream maybe, but it probably happened either every night or very close to every night. I probably was given juice instead of soft drink, but I didn't have access to things like muesli bars. And now, from a muesli bar perspective, there is no such thing as a good muesli bar. Muesli bars are all high in sugar.
Every nutritionist will tell you that pretty much too.
Yeah, they will, yes. But that doesn't stop them being marketed to our kids on a constant basis. And to busy parents, this is the thing to throw into a lunchbox, and that's a bad thing.
When did you start, as growing up, when did you start to get, let me put this nicely as possible, on the cuddly side, the slightly large side?
I think it was probably a constant thing. I was probably overweight for as long as I can remember, but just over the years got heavier and heavier. There was a little bit in university where I found it easier to be in the gym than paying attention in lectures, and I did lose a fair bit of weight doing that. Constantly, you spend 24 hours a day in the gym, you lose weight. But other than that was the only stop in my onward upward campaign to get fatter and fatter.
Did you try dieting in this period?
Constantly. Never in an organised sort of a way. I never signed up to any program or anything like that, but you'd hear about it on the news and, you know, the latest asparagus diet or something like that. You know, I could give that a go. So I tried lots of things, and some of them worked for a week or two that I could stand to be on them. And then, you know, hunger would get the better of me and I couldn't stand it any longer. I'd come off the diet, the fat would come back, and usually with interest.
What kind of sugary treats were you particularly fond of before you gave it up?
Soft drink. I could not walk past a soft drink vending machine. My absolute favourite thing was to, you know, anywhere I'd see, I just, even if I wasn't thirsty, I had to have a soft drink. So it was probably my biggest weakness.
What was your work life? What was happening in your work life? Because you set up your own quite successful IT company, didn't you?
Yes.
So this was all going on while you were getting bigger and bigger.
That's right. Unfortunately, it involved a lot of travel, usually to the United States. If you think there are a lot of soft drink vending machines here, you should see the United States. Everywhere I went, there were plenty of soft drink. And usually you couldn't even have a meeting without someone having it on the table.
I know, that's funny. In America, yeah. They do that, don't they? You go and you sit down and someone's putting out some sparkling cola beverage of one kind or another.
Exactly.
And it's there, right next to the water. It goes, there, the water, yeah.
That's right. No one touches the water.
That's right.
There's always plenty of soft drink.
What was you said it was a you'd had a few kids. You met your wife, yep. Lizzie, and what was it that Lizzie said to you that made you want to be more serious about giving up weight?
We're having twins. we had four kids under the age of nine at that point.
Oh, you already had four.
We already had four, and we were having our last child, except that our last child turned into twins, and I was struggling to cope with the four, let alone add another two exactly the same age babies to that mix. And I thought, look, something's got to give here. I've got to lose this weight. I can't keep going on this path.
So you tried the Atkins diet for a bit, the famous Atkins diet, which just says cut out the carbohydrates. You can have as much protein and fat as you like, yep. more or less.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe not so much fat, but that's what it says. Mainly protein. Give up the carbs. That's the big thing.
That's right.
Now, I've known people who've tried that, and they seem to have lost weight. Did it work for you?
Yeah, absolutely it did. Look, it was the most effective diet I had tried to that point. Immediately lost weight. Very, very effective. Except I couldn't stand it. After 2 weeks, I just couldn't stand going into the supermarket and finding almost nothing I was allowed to eat. It just drove me nuts. You're not allowed to eat pasta, you're not allowed to eat bread, you're not allowed... And you think about it, pasta and bread is in everything. And I couldn't stand that. So I stopped it. And the weight came straight back.
What led you then to look at sugar, and more specifically fructose, as part of your diet?
Well, the first thing that made me curious was that the Atkins diet worked so effectively. Now, all it had done was remove carbohydrates. And so I thought, well, what is it about carbohydrates that makes that so effective? And it surely can't be the case that we have been designed or evolved to live without carbohydrates. It can't be that. So I started doing some research. I came across some early work done by a fellow in the School of Nutrition in London by the name of Yudkin, who had pretty much come to the same conclusion and decided, well, there's something about carbohydrates, and he decided to test it. So he did lots of interesting experiments with rats where he decided removing various things. And what he narrowed it down to over a course of years, a number of papers, was that there was one part of sugar, the fructose part, which was doing all the damage. He could feed rats the glucose half, no problems at all. They'd be perfectly fine. But when he fed them the fructose half, all sorts of nasty things started happening to these rats.
The fructose that's in all our food.
Now, these were rat studies, okay? So let's not get too excited about a rat study. But it was certainly a clue that maybe there was something about that fructose half. And he went on to start doing studies in humans as well and was starting to get very, very similar results. His research got picked up by the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, who have a group who did this kind of research in the 70s and 80s. And they repeated same experiments, because obviously if you do it in America, you've got to do it. Probably can't just copy some guy from the UK. So they repeated the experience, got the same results. They moved on to humans as well. And their human trial, interestingly, had to be abandoned because four of the participants had adverse events with hearts, a variety of events. But they decided on ethical grounds they needed to stop with humans. But they felt, even before finishing it, that they'd gotten enough evidence to agree that what they were observing in rats was happening in humans too.
I'll just correct something I said. Yeah. I shouldn't have said in all our supermarket food. That was a big clip. I've got to be careful what I say in these cases, but I'll say in many of our processed
foods.
In supermarkets. So having read that, then researching into this, like I say, you're not a doctor, you're not a nutritionist.
No.
What made you feel you could sort of read this competently, to be perfectly honest?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I couldn't. At first, I was a lawyer, and what I was doing was looking for evidence. So what I was trying to make out was, what is the case for this theory that fructose has these evil effects on us? At the same time, sort of a little way into it, I was trying out a one-on-one experiment by eliminating fructose from my diet, or trying to as much as I could, and seeing what happened. The thing I was noticing by my own little experiment was that my own weight was dropping very quickly, and that there were changes in the way my appetite worked and the way I felt about food. So I noticed that myself, but I was reading these studies, and I was starting easy. I was starting in the 1960s, when nobody knew much about any of this at all. They were just observing some rats, and I was looking at that evidence. And then I was moving up to a little more complex papers about, and I certainly had to to seek help in understanding those. And fortunately, I know quite a lot of people in the medical fraternity, and I was able to ask questions about, this paper says this, is this a good journal, should I believe what it says, those sorts of questions. But I also, by virtue of a bit of luck, at around this time, was moving out of the IT company and was having quite a bit more time on my hands to study these things for myself. And I'm the kind of person that when they see something, can't leave it alone until they are convinced that they understand it properly. And so I would obtain biochemistry textbooks. I would obtain further papers around the subject on the net. And this all took vast amounts of time, but luckily I had plenty. And so I taught myself to understand these things. And what I did was write down those notes so that I could come back to it and understand the evidence in a plain English way.
So all this time you're losing weight. How much weight did you lose?
I lost 40 kilograms.
Over how long? What sort
probably of about 18 months. I wasn't measuring it at the time. I didn't think one day I'd be talking to you about it. but it was probably about that 18-month range.
And perhaps more importantly, you say you noticed you didn't feel like you needed to eat so much.
That was the really interesting thing, is that my appetite really did change.
Your appetite suppressants came roaring back.
Roaring back. And what it meant was two effects. First of all, when I was hungry, I was really hungry, like really hungry. You know, stop, get out of the car, I've got to eat now kind of hungry. Something I had never experienced before in my life.
Well, and that's real hunger, you're saying.
Yeah, I'm saying that's real hunger. I had never felt that. I had felt all my life the kind of hunger which I think most people feel today.
A vague dissatisfaction.
Vague, I could eat something, yeah. Kind of, you know. I could eat something now. The other thing I noticed was that when I was full, I was really full. My, you know, suddenly it would be bang, right in the middle of a meal or something that formerly I would have been able to get through no trouble and ask for dessert. I'm feeling like, oh my, yeah, I can't finish this meal. And it really was a disturbing sensation in that sense.
So then you published your thinking on this with this book, and then all hell broke loose to some degree. Tell me about the differing responses you got from, for instance, doctors. What do doctors' organisations and doctors say about what the evidence you're putting forward here?
Most doctors, initial response from most doctors is, yeah, I've kind of sort of heard something about that. And if you talk to a doctor that's dealing with cancer patients, they'll often say, yes, we advise cancer patients not to consume sugar because sugar feeds a cancer. Certain doctors that have had anything to do with the endocrine system, which is our appetite control and so on, are pretty much across it. And they'll say, yeah, we agree with that. Other doctors will say, oh, I vaguely heard of something like that, and when I've got time, I'll check out what you're saying, but it sounds about right to me. Nutritionists, I had a very different response.
In what way?
Nutritionists pretty much are of the view that if the message isn't fat makes you fat and exercise makes you thin, then it's the wrong message. And by saying what
I'm... they're right though, aren't they?
They're not right.
Why aren't they right?
Okay, so there's a couple of things about that. Is I started out on the proposition, my research commenced with the idea that it must be fat that made me fat, because that's what everybody had told me to that point in my life. And I was looking for the evidence that would justify that. I only found the evidence on sugar as a sort of a peripheral aspect to looking for the evidence on fat. I came up dry time and time again. What I found is that when you look at something like our nutritional guidelines, so our current Australian National Nutritional Guidelines issued by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare, on which most of our dietary advice is based, you look at the evidence underlying those, which is usually put together by the Heart Foundation. You look at the evidence, the papers that they produce that produce the evidence. Look at the studies that they cite in support of that evidence. And they cite older studies. You go back and you look at those studies. Those studies cite older studies. And they're all consistently saying total dietary fat should be reduced if you're going to reduce heart events or health and maintain healthy weight. But you keep going back and back and back and back until you get to a series of studies in the 1950s, which really can't justify the outcome that it's now built into by way of sort of repeated mythology.
Still, it's a big call for you to make. I mean, you're a lawyer, you're untrained in medicine or nutrition.
I am trained in logic.
In logic. And you're putting yourself against the recommendations of the NHMRC and the Heart Institute and qualified doctors, very experienced medical experts in this, and you're saying they're wrong and you're right.
Well, it's not that they're wrong in that fat in the arteries definitely will cause heart disease. Where I'm saying they're wrong is where the fat comes from, in that dietary fat, that is the fat you consume as part of food, the evidence is just not there that that will cause fat in the arteries to the levels that we have been told it will. But sugar, the evidence is most definitively there that it will cause exactly that.
Exercise. Your argument on exercise is a really interesting one. Of course, the NHMRC says we need to eat less fat and exercise more and increase dietary fibre, those kinds of things, which is the accepted gospel on this thing. That's how we lose weight. That's how we reduce obesity.
That's right.
Exercise. You think they've got that backwards?
Let's first start of all by saying there's nothing wrong with exercise.
No,
okay?
Exercise
there are many good reasons to exercise. It's just that losing weight isn't one of them. And the problem with that is that the whole exercise myth is based on this theory of thermodynamics, you know, energy in must equal energy out kind of thing. And the only way you're going to lose weight is if you consume either less energy in or burn more energy out. The trouble is that if you actually look at the maths on how much you would have to do in order to burn any significant quantity of energy, it is ridiculous. You literally would be having to run 7 to 10 kilometres a day just to maintain a healthy weight. So it just doesn't stack up from a pure mathematical perspective. But it also doesn't stack up from a logical perspective.
Anecdotally, it does. Like, I've got a friend of mine who lost a lot of weight just by taking up cycling.
If you're going to be maniacal about it, like if you're going to do several hours a day of intense exercise, then it probably will result in weight loss. The trouble is most of us do not have the time or the motivation to do that. But we are told constantly that if we do 30 minutes of exercise a day, we will lose weight. And the evidence just is not there that that is true.
You say they've got the argument backwards. You
yes.
say lose weight, then you feel like doing more exercise.
Exactly. Now, I tell this from my own personal perspective, but it's also backed up by studies, which is that when I was overweight, exercise was the last thing in the world I was going to do. There's no way. You'd have to force me at gunpoint to do it. But as I lost the weight, and to today, it feels more like something I want to do. Like I want to take the dog for a walk, or I want to, you know, walk to the bus.
Because I'm not carrying all this lard around.
That's right. Well, it's 40 kilograms is a lot less to carry.
Yeah.
So you feel a lot more inclined to exercise. So the reality is I do exercise more now than I did before I lost the weight. But I don't exercise more now because I'm thinner or because I was fatter.
Your theories have been controversial, and you published an argument in Crikey. And
yep.
in response, the Heart Foundation rebutted to your arguments. And they said, I'm quoting here, "We advise that the best way for Australians to reduce their risk of cardiovascular disease is to reduce their intake of sodium," that's salt, obviously, "and saturated fat, and increase their intake of dietary fibre. Now, given cardiovascular disease is the number one killer of Australians, we dedicate significant resources to assessing and awarding the tick they give to meals and products that meet our strict criteria across a range of food categories." So what do you say to that?
Let's start from the back end first, the tick. The tick pays no regard to sugar content. I'm saying that based on observation because they don't publish the criteria for the tick. But the fact that they can give the tick to products which are sold to children which contain 70% sugar shows that they're low in fat, but they contain 70% sugar and they've got a tick.
I'm quoting them here again. "We believe that while overall kilojoule intake is important," and that's mm-hmm. what they mean by sugars, I'm thinking,
yeah.
"other factors such as levels of sodium, fibre and saturated fat are more important in preventing cardiovascular disease." So that's why they're not talking about sugar then. That's what you're saying.
That's right. The interesting thing is that when you look at the research that the Heart Foundation itself commissions, the last major review of the research they did was in 2001, and even that research comes out with some pretty interesting statements. I'm going below the press release
sure.
level here and looking at the research that they're relying on. The research they looked at comes out with some interesting statements. Statements like, "The total level of dietary fat intake makes no difference to heart disease." That replacing saturated fat with carbohydrates results in adverse outcomes in terms of heart disease. Statements like that are in their underlying research. So it doesn't match the marketing message that they're coming out with.
Unfortunately, I've got no way of checking that just at hand.
No, that's right.
But I will certainly after we speak. But
yes.
That's interesting.
So there's something I wanted to raise about the Heart Foundation. It's interesting because The American Heart Foundation, the American Heart Association, which has a similar mission to our Heart Foundation, published a major review on sugar in September last year. And their recommendation was that the average American adult should consume no more than 9 teaspoons of sugar a day. Now, given that there's 9 teaspoons of sugar in the average can of soft drink, that's a pretty severe limit. A woman should consume no more than 6 teaspoons a day, and a child no more than 3 teaspoons a day. You'll knock that over by breakfast without even touching the juice. So those are really severe limitations, and they published the research on which they relied in coming up with that. Our Heart Foundation has published nothing of the sort. In fact, the current recommendation in Australia is to have a quarter of your daily calories come from sugar.
David Gillespie is my guest in conversation. He says the main cause behind obesity these days is not fat in our diet and lack of exercise, as is commonly accepted, but in fact our high intake of sugar, which is laced through so many of the processed foods you buy in the supermarket. Nestle sent you a cease and desist letter. What did they say?
They were concerned about a product of theirs, which I wrote a blog piece about, saying, look, this is not on to advertise a product which is 70% sugar to children. And they wrote to me and said, but what you're missing is that it's not sugar. It's fructose. It's natural fructose.
Oh, it's fine because it's natural.
It's natural. Apparently, there's this thing called natural fructose, unknown to chemical science. I got a similar response, by the way, when I wrote to our own health minister about why in our own tuck shops juice is sold, is perfectly okay, but soft drink with an equivalent or lower amount of sugar isn't. And the answer I got was almost identical. What you're misunderstanding, Mr. Gillespie, is that that's natural fructose, whereas this is, you know, some other kind of fructose, I guess, is the dangerous one.
What role do food companies have then in... I mean, I'm just wondering, we don't really know much about this argument. Here's you. You're not a nutritionist. You're arguing this case. And we're not. Why aren't we hearing more of this argument? I mean, you're sort of saying that other people, organisations in the United States may be starting to allude to this a little more now.
Yep.
But what do you think the food companies have a role in this, in the fact that we don't hear more about this, about what the fructose that's present in so many of our foods that we get from them is having on us?
Some people like to suggest that I'm painting a picture of some giant conspiracy. I don't think there's any real conspiracy. I don't think they're sitting down talking to each other and saying, oh, look, make sure we don't get this message out there. But I think that there's a conspiracy of facts in the sense that food companies are amongst our largest advertisers. Our media depends on advertising dollars, except for the ABC. And so on a minute-by-minute basis, decisions might be made where there's a choice between two messages, one which might harm advertising revenue and one which might not, maybe there's a decision made there. Do I think that anyone is actively trying to prevent the message getting out there? No. But I do believe that circumstances will combine to ensure that there's no one who has an interest in the message getting out there. And when there's no one who has an interest in the message getting out there, it tends not to.
I just as you say this, I'm just wondering if it could be said or argued that much as cigarette companies don't really see themselves as not in so much in the cigarette delivery business, but the nicotine delivery business, many food companies might see themselves as in the sugar delivery business.
I'd be very surprised if they think of it that way, but the reality is that that's what they're doing. If I'm a food company and I'm selling an identical product and there's another one on the shelf beside me and it's a box of cereal, same as mine, the reality is that the one with more sugar will sell more. So I have to keep putting more in if I'm going to compete. It's just competition in action.
Governments always pledge to do something about obesity. It's very hard. They don't really know what to do in many cases. There was a federal parliamentary inquiry into obesity, and you made a submission. How did that go over?
Surprisingly well. In particular for one of the members, the co-chair of the panel, a fellow by the name of Steve Irons, who's a Liberal MP for Swan in Western Australia, took it on board so much. He read the book on the way home on the plane, and he contacted me and said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to give this a go. He then contacted me, I don't know, 10 or 12 weeks later and said, I've done it. I've lost 12 kilograms. I'm back down to the weight I wanted to be, and it was completely painless. I was amazed that a politician would take something that much to heart. He was there to inquire into obesity. He saw something which he thought must be a solution. He tried it, and it worked. And he is now an enormous proponent of this. He I'm sure he badges people to death around the halls of Parliament House.
Nonetheless, did your submission make it into the inquiry's recommendations?
No, not at all. And that's interesting. Now, Steve Irons, the fellow I was just talking about, got up and stood up as his chairman's response on the floor of Parliament and said pretty much what I've just said then. But no, it did not make it into the official recommendations.
So the simplest rule then, if we're to go about this by your advice, simply not eat sugar. How do we do that? You've got a supermarket rule, haven't you, about the periphery of the
supermarket?
That's
right.
Tell me how that works.
The easiest way, and this will save you a lot of time in the supermarket as well, is just shop the perimeter. Supermarkets put all the things we really need on the perimeter to drag you through the stuff you don't really need. So if you eat the fruit and veg, the meat, the dairy that you'll find, and the bread that you'll find all around the perimeter of a supermarket, you'll be fine. You'll avoid most of the sugar in our diet.
But do you mean no sugar at all?
It is impossible to eat no sugar at all. You simply cannot. You can't even eat bread without sugar added to it. But you can seriously minimise the amount of sugar that you eat.
How do your kids feel about you, you know, pretty much banning sugar from the house? You've got young kids. You've got six of them. Oh, no. Dad's got a crusade. Oh, no.
I'm sure if it was a vote, I might lose. Luckily, I have more votes than they do. We took it out of the house. So you remove sugar from the environment, it removes the options. Kids will then eat whatever's available. And if whatever's available isn't full of sugar, that's a good thing. So I don't suffer under the illusion that I've completely eliminated sugar from their lives, but I've certainly minimised it.
Tell me about Kevin Rudd and the chocolate cake.
What taught me that I had been addicted to sugar and that I'd gone through a withdrawal was that after I'd gone through withdrawal, I went to a dinner hosted by Kevin, who's my local member out of Morningside, and he at the dinner, it was one of those formal do's where they put stuff down in front of you, and one of the things they put down in front of me when I was completely sugar-free was this beautiful piece of chocolate cake, you know, mud cake, everything lovely. And I thought, oh, it'd just be rude if I didn't eat that. So I ate it. And what immediately happened the next day was I had cravings again. I needed sugar all over again. And I knew, okay, I've just messed up everything I've done.
Perhaps you can take Kevin a sugar-free treat to cheer him up. Great to speak with you, David. Thank you so much for being my guest in conversation today.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.